the Centre for Public Christianity. You're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, it's a familiar scene, at least from TV or the movies. A group of people sitting in a basement of a church, and one of them says, "Hi, my name is whoever, and I'm an alcoholic." But I imagine it's not an easy thing to admit. It certainly wasn't for Penny Wilkinson. She started drinking in high school, and it wasn't until she was married with three kids and well into her 30s that she thought that her drinking may actually be a problem.
Even then, it took a while for her to really seek help and to accept help. And later on, to her own surprise, she created a program to help others along with their own recovery from addiction. But we start from the beginning of her story.
In my teenage years, I could say that I drank like everybody else, but I didn't. I was the one being dragged out of the parties and put in the car. So, you know, I drank like everybody else that's like that, you know, and there's always one of those at a party. And it wasn't every party, but there were a couple of, you know, key moments that the family still raise every Christmas.
Yeah, but at that point, what was your sense of what was happening for you there? Was it just, were you thinking you were having fun, or was it deeper than that? Were you trying to overcome any sort of pain or not?
Absolutely no thinking, Simon. No. Put one in, take another one, get as much as I can.
But is that because you had that modelled for you, or you just thought that's what you did? Like what?
No, absolutely not. I grew up in a lovely family. They sat up every night and had a drink before dinner. I grew up on a farm. So, you know, everybody sort of came in at night and sat down and had a drink. It was really quite civilised.
So when did this become really a problem for you? When did this come to a head?
Really, for me, it was after I had children and, more importantly, after those three kids had gone to school. And you sort of, you know, life was so busy. I had three kids under three. Error number one.
Okay, that's a reason to start drinking. Yeah, load.
Yeah. And, you know, I eventually got those kids to school, all three of them. And, you know, so I guess the youngest one was six. And by the time they were at school, you know, there's a big gap between, you know, 9:30 and 3. It wasn't so much the gap. I think it was I loved the idea of a drink before dinner at 6 o'clock. And there was no civilised drinking at 6 o'clock with three kids under three, you know. And so I thought I took to sort of having a drink in the afternoon at 2 or 3 because I figured it'd be 6 o'clock somewhere around the world. It's funny, it all sort of feels very vague and it feels very strange to even talk about it because it's a bit like, you know, water creeping up. You sort of didn't notice it was creeping up. And so a lot of the habits I talk about are really regular Australian habits. You know, a lot of my drinking was really regular Australian kind of drinking.
By her mid-30s, Penny said that she had a sense that there's got to be more to life. Don't get me wrong, she was living a great life. She was married, three kids, a house in Sydney's affluent eastern suburbs. And yet there was still this thought that there's got to be more.
Two of her kids went to a local Christian school that Penny describes as very Christian and not the Anglicanism that she grew up with. She ended up joining a church that parents from that school went to and became a part of this wonderful community. And it was around this time that she started to question the level that her drinking had got to.
You ended up being taken, I understand, by a pastor to Alcoholics Anonymous. And did you go kicking and screaming? How did that happen?
Yeah, how did that happen? Good question. I came out of church one Sunday morning with a really bad hangover. I tried not to have a hangover of all days on Sunday morning. My hangovers were shocking by this stage. I thought, you know, I was aging really badly, but effectively my liver was about, you know, it had had enough. And I said to this friend, "Look, I'm really struggling. What do I do?" You know, and she said to me, "I've got a friend who's in Alcoholics Anonymous. I will get him to take you." And, you know, this guy came down, picked me up from the Northern Beaches. He was an emphysema machine. I'm like, "Man, you're sick. I'm like the well one here, you know." He said the same about me. And that's the cunning nature of alcoholism, how, you know, it just crept up on me. That was in August 2002. I went to one meeting. I took one look at them and just went, "Nah, I ain't having a bar of this. Thank you very much." And got out of there as fast as I could.
What was it that bothered you about it?
Oh, old men sitting in a room talking about things that I'd never done, really. That my drinking was nowhere near what their drinking was. And from there, I then went to have lunch with a couple of really good girlfriends who are Catholic, and they said, "Look, Pen, you've taken this whole Christianity thing way too seriously. You don't need to look at your drinking. You don't need to control it. You just need to drink whenever you feel like it." And that was in November 2002. And it was like the floodgates opened and I thought, yep, if I can just stay at 0.05 around the clock, I'll be fine.
And Is that what you did? So you took to drinking in a big way.
That was my theory. It just meant that, you know, there's a saying, you know, we kind of feel like we're one beer short of a six pack. And even though I never drank beer, I really got the handle of, you know, if there were six there, it was even. And I just didn't feel like I had both feet on the ground. And a couple of glasses of wine just made me sort of went in, filled me up, put my toes on the ground. I thought, yep, I can do whatever I need to do now. And so it gave me that lovely feeling that, you know, a couple of glasses of wine give us all.
But Alcoholics Anonymous, that was not the end of your story with AA. It wasn't that one meeting and then never
No, ran. That wasn't my one meeting. So needless to say, on this round-the-clock drinking program, you know, after failing...
Didn't work out for you.
Yeah, I failed the controlled drinking program. The controlled drinking program is two standard drinks a day and two free alcohol days a week. I was failing that rapidly. And it was coming up to Christmas. It was this season, November, December. And... So by the end of January, by the time I came back from a beach holiday, I'd laid on a beach and I had these three gorgeous kids. I mean, they were sort of 9, 10, 11 by this stage, and I had this gorgeous husband and we had, you know, the whole AMP life insurance picture. Like, it was really everything you could ask for. And I looked at that and I thought, you know what, I would give all this up for a glass of wine. And I just had a thought that maybe that wasn't a healthy thought. And so, yeah, at the time it was a deep heart desire, but that is the desire of an alcoholic. And so I had to come back and sort of really surrender that desire to my God of my understanding, for me, you know, which was the Christian God. And that meant for me, you know, I had to learn how to travel that path. I just knew nothing. I just knew nothing. So I came back and thankfully, yeah, there was a pastor who then took me to an AA meeting, the same one I'd been to in the August. And I sat there and I was just ready to bolt. I was just like, man, these are all the people my mother told me not to speak to. Like, what am I doing here, you know? But he thought it was fabulous being anonymous and he stayed. He thought it was fantastic. These people all wanted to talk about a higher power. I was like, no, I don't want to talk about nothing to these people. And, yeah, but look, I had nowhere else to go. So I kept sitting in those meetings for 3 months at the beginning of 2003, and they explained to me the condition of alcoholism, which the church had been unable to explain.
And it did fit your experience.
Well, I kept doing the experiment of the first drink, and the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous is that you have a phenomenon of craving. You have now brain neuroscience can talk about, you know, the way the brain works differently in an alcoholic to the way it works in a non-addicted person. And these guys were explaining stuff, finishing my sentences. And I was like, no! But, you know, no one else could explain why I would lie on a beach with such a beautiful picture and want to give it up.
Yeah.
And these guys could explain that.
So what happened then? Did this program help you to overcome this problem?
Yeah, absolutely. It was like a bad plane landing. I mean, some people go into Alcoholics Anonymous and the plane lands and it's perfect. Mine was like, you know, those bad plane, bang, bang, bang. Let's go off and do another round, bang, bang, bang. But eventually my plane landed and, you know, I had a miraculous experience. So eventually I'd been in AA for a couple of months and there was a particular Wednesday in March and I sought out an addiction psychiatrist because I figured, you know, I was different and I definitely needed a diagnosis. I needed someone to say, you definitely are or you definitely not. As far as I was concerned, there was plenty of doubt. As far as the rest of the people in the eastern suburbs, I wasn't drinking any more than most people. Why do I have to be alcoholic? So I go to see this psychiatrist and he said, yeah, if you were in France, you wouldn't be, this would be a perfectly reasonable level. I went home from that appointment and thought, you know what, we need to move to France. This is, you know. And isn't it funny?
Solution.
Yeah, it gets a laugh out of you. It gets a laugh out of everyone in AA too. But, and on that Monday, you know, I took the inevitable first drink, which set up a craving. You know, I was then terribly drunk and got in the car and picked up one of the kids and, you know, missed a row of parked cars. And in doing that, you know, I heard a voice say, there's your sign. I was like, whoa, that's not fair, maker of the universe. Like, you can't play the game that, you know, I want another sign. And the next voice sort of said, well, what do you want to do, kill the kid? And it was a pause moment, you know. Do I want to destroy my entire life or do I want to admit I'm alcoholic? And, you know, sitting at the top of where I was, that was a big decision that I was actually unable to make. And the next voice said, you have Moses and the prophets, even if someone comes back from the dead, you won't believe. And I had studied the Old Testament, I'd studied the Passover, I'd studied how Jesus had been you know, the awaited Messiah. And I was basically checkmated by the maker of the universe. I mean, I was like, yeah, I believed he'd come back from the dead, but I couldn't believe I was alcoholic. And so I got home, put the car away, tidied everything up, as you do. And the next day, like nothing had happened the day before, I picked up the inevitable first drink again. And this is the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you know, you are powerless over that first drink. And that's what I realised the next day. That was the 18th of March, 2003. And by God's amazing grace, the next day I didn't pick up a drink. I went back to the psychiatrist. I thought we were going to have a discussion about whether or not I was alcoholic. I told him about those last 2 days and the poor bloke just fell off his chair and said, you are this close to being in trouble with the law. Like, how can you not think you're alcoholic? And I thought, well, if you didn't speak to me that rudely for that much money, I might as well go to AA. And I marched myself into AA that day and I've never looked back.
What's life like since this? And do you feel confident that you've sort of beaten this addiction?
Yeah, there's no beating it, really. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, you know, we are like men who've lost our legs. So you learn to live as an amputee. You learn to live as somebody who's unable to drink alcohol.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Penny's experience with AA had its ups and downs, but the program eventually led her on a path to recovery from alcoholism. It also led her to develop a new program to help alcoholics who had a belief system that was similar to hers.
Going into Alcoholics Anonymous with a Christian higher power in 2003 was a really hard experience. And, you know, I survived and I got through and I made a lot of good friends in AA. But I found when I took friends from Alcoholics Anonymous to church with me, they just said, what are you doing here? Look at these people. You know, they just had the most awful spiritual experience with many people at church. And, you know, like, I don't know, like taking the tax collector to church, they were the ones who were looked down on, and yet they were the ones living by grace. And so it became a really, you know, I mean, I kind of knew I needed church. Church had become part of my life and I wanted to carry on with my church life. You know, I had a Christian higher power, but I also knew I desperately needed to be part of a fellowship that understood my mental condition. And so around the world, there's a lot of Christians who've been involved in addiction recovery. You know, Frank Retief has a fantastic program in South Africa called Alcoholics Victorious. Celebrate Recovery out of Saddleback Church is a fantastic program. But a lot of the programs I looked at wanted to either replace church or replace AA. And for me, both had been very effective in my journey. And so I wanted something that could just travel, you could travel across like a bridge. And so the model I looked at was in the UK and the US was Overcomers Outreach. And I understood the journey the guy had started it. It was a very similar journey to mine. And I thought, no, we can work this model in Sydney. And we started at St Andrew's Cathedral in 2006. And, you know, for the first 2 years, really, it was like two or three of us sitting in a room together going, what are we doing? And after about 2 years of that, and there were all sorts of problems, you know, the key wouldn't be there, the door wouldn't be there, you know, the heater would be stuck on and 30 degree heat, you know, there'd be all little problems. After about 2 years of that, I remember swearing one day, walking up to the car going to my husband, you know, why am I doing this? And I got the answer. It's like, because any other bugger would have quit. And I wasn't a quitter. And, you know, today there's now 10 groups and there's 20 or 30 people at groups and people get so much out of it.
Is there something that all of us can learn from programs like this and not just those who are addicts?
In 2008, the healing service at St Andrew's Cathedral recruited their third leader in 50 years, Chris Allen. And he came on board. He was this young, smart, bright, you know, keen, enthusiastic young minister. And I took one look at him and thought, oh, really? You know, I'd burned through a few ministers by this stage. And he and I have worked together really successfully since then, because the thing he learned that he took away from the steps was powerlessness, you know, which is all through the scriptures, like we're powerless. But he almost got it more than I got it. Like, I understood I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't understand I was powerless over him. But he understood he was powerless over me, and he demonstrated that to me in the most loving, caring way.
So you're saying that the sense of powerlessness leads you then what to rely on or turn towards God? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, to understand that, you know, there is a higher power in charge and that that higher power has a better plan than anyone you can come up with.
It's clear that this road to recovery has not been easy or straightforward for Penny. And it has been really hard on those closest to her. This is probably the hardest thing for Penny to talk about, actually. The impact of her drinking on the people she loves.
Penny, what's this journey been like for your family?
My children have been affected. I would have liked to have thought they weren't. Right at the moment, we are living in the evidence of some of that effect. So it's a little raw. It's a journey. You know, they're God's children as much as they're mine. And if I had my time, I could go back and change things. I would have. But I've seen mothers whose kids are in their late 20s when they got sober, and I've seen mothers who got sober before they had kids. Family is family. It's still always a journey. And, you know, I would have liked mine to have been perfect, and it's not. Yeah, I'm learning that.
And, Penny, what about in terms of, I think of that person, or there were a couple of people along the way who said to you, you know, Penny, you've got a problem here. That always feels like that's certainly an awkward moment. People who have the addiction tend to resist the idea that they have it, right? So they're not going to go, oh, yeah, thanks for telling me that.
Yeah, let's have a talk about your problems in your life. Yeah. Because the problem does seem so insurmountable, you know, even to the addict. I think the hardest thing is understanding that a non-addict won't have the same mental mechanisms. And that is the really big gift of being with other like-minded people. And even if it's not alcohol, you know, if it's gambling, there's Gamblers Anonymous. If it's drugs, there's Narcotics Anonymous. You know, there's this strange mental twist that goes on in the alcoholic mind that, you know, you can't recall the damage. You just can't recall the damage at the point of time when you make that decision to take that first drink. And so there's a process in early recovery that trains you out of it. And only another alcoholic, I believe, can really do it. For someone, which is where, you know, it's great to see therapists and psychologists and all the rest of it, but it's not an investment that's always helpful to the alcoholic.
So if someone has a friend or a family member who they see, like they're pretty sure they're in this situation, what advice would you give them? Like, what should they do practically?
For them, they need to go to Al-Anon, which is the group for family and friends that Bill W.'s wife first set up, Lois. And it has a whole similar sort of instructions as it does to the alcoholic. Normally what happens is they've got into the whirlpool of addiction, of the addictive cycle with the addict. So the things they're doing are quite unique, but they would be, you know, as the alcoholic drinks, they do something, the alcoholic drinks, they do something, and it just keeps that whirlpool going. And Al-Anon will help them get out of that whirlpool and stay sane. For me, that friend that took me to that first meeting in August 2002, even though I didn't get sober straight away, absolutely planted the seed. Like if that friend had said, oh, no, we're going to sit on the step and you know, pray, or we're just going to clean up your vomit, or, you know, I'll take your kids for you or whatever. But no, the one thing they did for me that was absolutely pure gold was took me to a meeting, put my bum in a seat, let me hear whether I liked it or not. What she did was she gave me a place that I knew I could get to when I needed help.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. If you want to find out more about Overcomers Outreach, please visit overcomersoutreach.net.
If you want to listen to this interview again or more episodes from our podcast, you can find us at publicchristianity.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do leave us a rating or review and hit subscribe. It helps other people discover our show.
Next week, where does this unreasonable thing called hope come from? This is just one of the questions Tom McLeish, a theoretical physicist, was asking himself, and he found the answer in a pretty unexpected place.
For me, Christianity and my experience of Christianity has lit the world up in a helpful, consistent, and challenging way that no other worldview does.